Good morning, everybody, and everybody out there. It is Friday, May 27th, the start of a holiday weekend, and we are live on Facebook, and we have another great speaker with us today. But before we do that, Chris, TGIDF.
TGIDF.
And we know that that means, thank goodness, it's Divorce Friday.
But not because it's divorce, but because you get to learn about divorce if you happen to have the need.
Yes. And that is exactly right, Chris. We are the podcast that answers your financial questions about divorce. I'm Diane Pappas, and we have Chris Chen here, and we have our repeat guest, attorney Sandy Lundy, who's been a family law attorney or an attorney for a long time. And she is currently an attorney with Richardson Law. She's also a mediator. And an interesting thing that Sandy just told us is that she has a doctorate in English, which that is very cool. And Sandy has also served as the senior attorney to the Supreme Judicial Court for at least 12 years, which is one reason why she has such a wealth of insight when it comes to divorce cases, and which is one of the reasons we go to her when we have a conversation like this, which today we are talking about the intersection or the interplay of child support and alimony. Now, this is part of our alimony series, and this is our last episode with a guest speaker. Next week, Chris and I will be joining you just to summarize our whole series. But we did cover this topic back last year in our child support series, and so we need to cover it again this time from the aspect of alimony and child support.
One more interesting thing about you, Sandy. I think you are on Nantucket, are you?
I'm in Provincetown.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. We do have offices in Nantucket, but we have offices throughout Massachusetts. Right. Yeah.
Provincetown is just as interesting to me.
Better. Better. And thank you both for having me on here.
Well, thank you for joining us as a repeat as a repeat guest. I guess we didn't scare you last time.
No, it's always a pleasure.
Excellent. Okay. So I guess, as Dan, you were saying, we're talking today about the interplay of child support and alimony. The point there being that in many, many cases, there is only child support involved. And in some cases, you have a combination of child support and alimony. And so perhaps we should go and review what the basic breakdown is about, at what level do we normally also have alimony on top of child support. And then the law being what it is, then we can start talking about the exceptions. So Sandy, at what point does a couple who is divorcing and who have children end up being an alimony case from an income standpoint?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The alimony, the child support guidelines used to be capped at 250, and everything over 250 was used to calculate alimony. Well, now the child support cap has been raised to $400,000. And I think there's a lot of discussion about, do we use the whole $400,000 and then we calculate, and then we talk about alimony? Do we not, you know, do we use the old 250 still in certain circumstances? But the law says now that the first $400,000 is considered for child support.
Right. So, and what that does is, since I'd have to say the majority of couples have combined gross income of less than 400,000. So in the case of when you have children, that could just be all child support, and that's it, if their income is under 400.
Except that the child support guidelines, one of the words that keeps running through the child support guidelines is discretion, mm-hmm. right? The judge has discretion. And basically that word and the way it's been interpreted in appeals and the appellate decisions is judges have a wide berth of how they cut up or how they decide support and also how they cut up the marital estate. As long as it's rational and in some sense, in some situations, a judge has to make written findings. But if it, even if the standard is, even if the appeals court judges would have done it differently, if the trial judge, if the probate and family court judge has a reason for doing what he or she did that is not irrational, then the appeals court will accept it. Yeah. Right. So there's a lot of wiggle room in there.
Right. Yeah, there is. And, you know, so the question becomes, if your income is under 400, what would warrant a combination of child support and alimony?
Well, you can look at the ages of the parties and the ages of the children, for instance. If the children are in, already launched in college or ready to go into college and the parties are in their 50s, what that means is that child support is going to end pretty soon. And without alimony, assuming the recipient spouse really needs that support, that child support's going to go away pretty quickly. Right. So in those circumstances, you might want to consider unallocated, or you might want to consider alimony, or do the alimony calculations first and then do the child support calculations, because there still may be a claim for alimony because the spouse will need it going forward. So the child support guidelines specifically say that, let me back up. It's a myth that you always have to calculate child support first.
Right.
It's a myth, and it's actually in the guidelines that mm-hmm. you don't always have to calculate child support first. You can calculate alimony first. You can calculate unallocated support and tax consequences. What you need to do is find the best result for your client and present it to the judge in a rational way.
Right. I think that's an interesting point that you brought up here. And if you don't mind, I'd like to go over some of it again, sure. So that we can clarify a little bit for our audience that doesn't deal with divorce every day.
Yeah, sorry.
No problem. Right. So I think the point that you brought about alimony first, right, is that in the most recent child support guidelines, the one that went into effect in October of 21, it specifically says that this is a possibility to calculate alimony first and child support next. And in this way, we go around that limit of 400K.
Yes. Yeah.
Right. And so is that something that you see used a lot?
That's something that I'm using in a case right now. And, the two kids are in college. The parents are in their 50s. There's a huge disparity in their incomes. And it just doesn't make sense given the need and the ability to pay, in this case, the need of the recipient spouse and the ability to pay of the payor, to calculate child support first. It just doesn't make sense given the ages and the situations of the parties.
Right.
What judges like sometimes is if you calculate a whole bunch of different scenarios and you show them why your scenario makes sense within the context of the family. I mean, I think the tricky part for attorneys is you don't want to present to the judge something that may end up unfavorable to your client, but you want to really be able to clearly explain. And that also means telling the judge, and this is also in the child support guidelines, what the tax consequences are. You know, if you're doing unallocated support, you're expected to tell the judge what the tax consequences are for the family.
Yeah. Well,
getting back, I'm sorry, to unallocated support, right? So just for the audience there, so unallocated support basically means that is a combination of child support and alimony, spousal support, and we call it unallocated and basically make it all alimony, which means in today's tax regime in particular, that when the children are no longer there, that the payments can still continue without having to go to a modification.
Yeah, it's a classic case of neither fish nor fowl. Yeah. It's really right. It's either alimony with a kicker or child support with a kicker.
Right. Well, one of the things that we do as Chris and I, as CDFAs, is we do all those different options for people. So when we're hired by our by a client and an attorney, and they want to see all those different options, we will do it. I'll do child support first, then alimony, then, you know, alimony, then child support. And just to clarify, when we do alimony first, we are using that alimony as income, and we're reducing the payor's income when we put that into the child support worksheet. So we are not, double dipping in income there. We are using the income for the recipient, and maybe they have their own income as well. So that's why, you know, we're taking that income into account when we do the child support calculation. But the thing that you want to look at, Sandy, like you were saying, you want to make sure it benefits your client. The thing that we're looking at is we want to make sure that the net after-tax income is going to be similar to what it would have been when alimony was tax deductible and taxable. So when we're talking about tax consequences, we're saying we don't want to give somebody more income than they would have had, or take away more of their income than they would have had under the old rules. We're trying to find the tax equivalent so that both parties have enough cash flow after they're paying all this to also support their own lifestyle, you know, right, their daily living and housing needs.
I think it's an interesting point that you bring up there about the mechanics, because doing both child support and alimony can be daunting for people, right? And when you do the alimony first, as we've discussed here, is effectively that reduces child support if you do child support next, right? Because you're counting the alimony recipient's alimony income as an income that usually she has, and so therefore it reduces the child support.
Yep.
You had brought up earlier the question of taxes, mm-hmm. Sandy, which we had, I think we have sort of gone around that topic in the past several episodes, Diane, but without addressing it up front, right? And so, actually, we did. No, never mind, we did, right? Mm-hmm. And so, basically, under today's regime, which is a post-TCJA regime, that's the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, alimony is no longer deductible from the payor's income and is no longer taxable to the recipient. So the question is, since it is the way that it is, how much more tax analysis do we need to do?
Well, you want, I'm sorry, Diane, did you want to take that?
No. I mean, I would say in my mind, there isn't a tax analysis unless you are trying to calculate what the new alimony figure is post TCJA, because, and let's just get back to go really back, Chris, is that our statute for alimony says the recipients need, or 30 to 35% of the difference of the party's gross income. But we now know that if we stuck with those 30 to 35% percentages, it doesn't work anymore, because those percentages were based on the fact that the payor of alimony was getting a tax deduction dollar for dollar for what they were paying in alimony. So that's why the 30 to 35% percentages worked. They don't work anymore. It would give the recipient way too much money because it's no longer taxable. And it would really deplete the payor's income because he or she's not getting a tax deduction anymore. So the reason why we're doing this calculation is because Massachusetts has not updated their guidelines since the TCJA.
Yeah, I suppose that they felt, Massachusetts felt they didn't need to do that because the alimony law provides discretion for tax analysis in it, doesn't it?
Right, right. But, you know, then it's like, okay, then people were just pulling flat numbers out of thin air and saying, okay, it's now 25%. Okay, maybe on average, the 30 to 35% equals 25%, but not always.
Not always.
I was in court yesterday where the judge said, I'm just going to take, you know, attribute income to him, attribute income to her, and take 25% of the difference. And it was like, this is what I always do. I'm not changing. I don't see any reason to change. Right. But you want to know what the effective tax rate is, because what the law says is we want to make sure that taking all the taxes into consideration doesn't give the person who's getting unallocated support less than they would get in child support and alimony. So it's a little complicated, but the other way the judges say it is we want to maximize the overall available income to the parties.
Right.
So, you know, taxes are not income available to the parties. So that's another reason the judges want to see tax analysis. In fact, I was just telling Diane and Chris, I was at a seminar where these issues were discussed, and all the judges there, I think there were four judges on the panel, said they wanted to see a tax analysis, especially if there was unallocated support.
Right. Well, I think, you know, when you say tax analysis, everyone's like, oh, a CPA. But
yeah, no.
And it also, it sounds really complicated to do a tax analysis. Yeah. It's not, actually, because all we're doing is we're looking at net after-tax income. And we're looking at what income is available to both parties. And is that fair? Does it meet the recipient's need? And does it still provide an ability to pay?
Right.
And so it's not this complicated thing that you have to run through all kinds of different tax software. It's really, you also have, you know, then you have to look at the party's expenses. And we always go back to this, their monthly expenses, what it costs to run their household, what their, you know, daily living expenses are, food, you know, dining out, the children, how much. That's what we're looking at. We're looking at that net income first after taxes with no expenses, because that's how we do it first. Then we look at it with expenses and compare and say which one of these provides the most amount of income to both parties so that they can meet their needs of paying their expenses going forward.
And that's such an important point, because you really, you can't give a judge too much information, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you want to give them the information they need to really make a thoughtful decision, particularly if, and there's no cookie cutter case, but particularly if it's a judge that may tend to just do the same thing all the time and you want something different, or particularly if there are special circumstances in the for the parties, and you want to be able to give the judge what he or she needs to say, this is a really sound decision that really fits the circumstances of these parties. And
yeah.
And yeah, it's really good to emphasize that this is, it doesn't mean you need an army of accountants behind you.
Nope, not
so
at all.
So just to counter that point a little bit, right, is that we covered income in a previous episode, right? And that the analysis of income is not always simple, right? And it does require, you know, gray cells and whatnot. It does require time. Yes. And sometimes you can come with different results if you spend a little bit more time at it, right? So it's not always that simple.
Yeah. Oh, I think we're all saying the same thing, basically, right? That you know, you've got to thoughtfully look at all the different scenarios, but doing that isn't going to cost the parties an arm and a leg. That's
right. And also, yeah, you were just talking about income. That's your first step, is to establish the income. Like if you have a, you know, W-2 employees, that's pretty easy. But when you start having W-2 income with variable income, like bonuses and executive compensation, other types of income, you have to, you, in order, and then I guess, you know, a lot of times in litigation, both sides cannot agree to the income being used, but that really is, especially in mediation and ADR, alternative dispute resolution, that's the first thing you want to do is agree on what incomes you're using. Because if both parties are going to court and using different incomes, the judge is going to get totally different figures.
Yeah. And we don't want to confuse a judge.
No. And you also don't, you know, I mean, just to emphasize something Diane said, the more you can keep it in-house and not bring it to court, yeah, almost always the better off you are, because you can make decisions for your family that a judge doesn't even have available to him and her or her, because, you know, their creativity is limited by statutory provisions.
Right. And you were also saying, you know, when someone tells their story in court, you know, that financial statement is supposed to be your story. It's supposed to represent, you know, your situation as, you know, the day you're there in court, but the judge has limited time to look at that. And you know, the judge has all these other cases after you. And, you know, unfortunately, the judge really isn't going to take the time to understand your case and your particular family scenario and situation. So again, that's why trying to do as much as you can outside of court is really the best thing to really have your concerns, your needs, and your goals heard and addressed.
I just heard a retired judge tell me that she always, before she starts the joint conciliation, always spends time talking to the parties separately, because she found that one of the most frustrating things for the parties is they feel like they never got a chance to speak in court. They never told their story in court. And this is, again, this is something that can enrich your decision-making when you use alternate dispute resolution.
That sounds like a really enlightened and compassionate judge. Right.
Yeah,
We don't see a lot of that, I think, right? I mean, most of the time they're humans too, but they get, they're crumbling under a heavy workload, and they're just trying to get from one case to the next a lot of the time, right?
Well, yeah, and this judge said to me, thank God I'm not in the courts anymore. You know, she's a retired judge. So it's not that the judges don't want to, but every day they hear maybe 10, 12 heartbreaking cases about child abuse or domestic violence or whatever. And it's really easy in those circumstances to, you know, that's their first job, is to protect kids. And the financial, as long as one party isn't going to be thrown out on the street, I mean, they absolutely consider it carefully, but they may not take the time that you have sitting informally or outside of the courtroom to really get down into what makes sense for the family.
Yeah, I mean, I remember going through my own divorce, and we had an issue, and you know, I wanted to be able to, I said, well, wouldn't the judge listen to me? And my attorney said, you know what, I don't think it's worth to go to court, because based on your situation, the judge doesn't really care about you. He's concerned about the people that have no money, the people that are out of the jobs, the families where the children, you know, are suffering. And he's like, sorry, judge is going to say nope. And really, unfortunately, they don't care. As you know,
it's not so much that they don't care, is that they don't have time to care.
They don't have the bandwidth. Nobody has the bandwidth, given how much goes through the probate and family court.
Sure.
But there's another point I want to make, which is that people shouldn't be locked into this binary, you know, it's alimony or child support, and that's all we have to think about, because there are special needs trusts. There are considerations about payments for college. There are considerations, extracurricular payments. All of these should be part of the package. And maybe in some scenarios, it makes sense to do child support one way, but have one of the parties more responsible for college costs or more responsible for extracurriculars. And in some cases, it makes sense to pour the money that would have gone into child support into those other things. Although, you know, judges don't always like like those arrangements.
I mean, I think that's a very important point that you're making there. It's not just child support and alimony. Is that when we're talking about child support and alimony, that's because there are children. And a lot of the time, maybe not, if not all of the time, the cost of children is going to be greater than the child support is providing, right? So I think Diane had a case that she was suggesting that there was this large disparity in income and they had some exceptional expenses. And she was suggesting that perhaps these expenses could be weighed one side instead of the other. Maybe Diane, you want to tell us more about the case?
Sure. Well, it's a pretty typical scenario and I'm running into it, you know, a lot. So we have older kids who are in high school. In this particular case, they are in private school. So there is a tuition expense. This is not college. This is high school, of about $120,000 a year. So the question is, well, if the husband, and right now the husband is paying for tuition, the wife is working. But the question is, you know, we're a child support or alimony. Well, you know, he's saying, well, I pay for college. Why should I pay for child support? And I said, okay, but then, you know, we do need some support here. So is it alimony? And then maybe if it's alimony, then maybe the wife should contribute to the tuition. And then he was saying, well, why should I just give her money when she's just going to give it right back? And I'm like, because that's our guidelines. We need to do something. It gets really confusing, Sandy. You know, what do we do?
And again, that's another reason for keeping things in house before bringing them to the court. I mean, you know, clearly in that case, the family is committed to keeping the kids in private school.
Yes.
But the wife, it sounds like, needs some support.
She does.
So there's got to, you know, it really is what's available for support for her is effectively reduced by $120,000 a year.
Right. Yeah.
But plus taxes.
Yeah.
Because this is an after-tax cost.
Mm-hmm. Right, 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 right. So, you know, I don't see how you can ask the dad to double dip in that way. But, you know, and sometimes, you know, sometimes there is not a good answer and the judge will say, oh, so-and-so should go out to work or so-and-so, you know, and sometimes sometimes there just isn't a perfect answer. And if a couple, for instance, lived off of a lot of debt, and there's not enough money for alimony, or, you know, there's only a little bit left for alimony, that's just a bad situation that people need to, the courts can't fix it.
Right, can't fix it, exactly. There's only so much income. But I just want to go back a minute to the high school tuition and everything. So most of the income is above base income. So we have a small amount of base income because in this particular circumstance, all the income is earned in a bonus and executive compensation like stock options. Mm. So what, you know, the thought initially was because the wife does need a regular support payment, let's do alimony on the base income. And that provides at least, you know, it's still not enough for her to pay for, you know, rent and everything else that she was accustomed to. Of course, everybody's lifestyle has to go down a little bit, typically. And then part of the bonus, you know, should be also for support, but, you know, that doesn't, only comes once a year. So it's, again, it's not consistent. And then maybe the executive comp or vice versa can be earmarked towards the tuition. You know, high school tuition now, college tuition in the future. And you earmark a certain point, and then when the obligation for college is over, then we revisit and say, what now, because it is a long-term marriage, there's still some time left for alimony. Now we can do maybe a full alimony.
I think it's a difficult case that you bring up there, because we're talking about the category of expense, which is certainly not everyone sends their kids to private school, right? And it's not a need. They could go to public school, right? And then Sandy, you're bringing up that they sound committed to private schools, and that makes sense. But it sounds like sort of unusual, if you will, right? And if it were college, for instance, the guidelines would say that neither of them are obligated to pay more than half of the cost of UMass Amherst, and the costs that you are bringing up there are greater than that.
Yeah.
Right? And so there is no limit for private school, but there is a limit for college.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point, Chris. But, you know, it you have to ask yourself in the end, what is the right, you know, parents have a right to set their priorities for their kids. And, you know, but that even, and if it means making sacrifices, I mean, there's no situation that's going to satisfy the wife's needs all the, you know, so if there is a shared sacrifice in some way between the wife and the husband, that's pretty much the best you're going to get.
Yep.
You know?
So I was bringing up with Diane, okay, so what happened if they were, instead of divorcing, they were married, maybe unhappily, and he lost his job. Would they then quit the private school and go to public school? And then now that they are divorcing, isn't that sort of similar?
Mm-hmm. You know,
and I'm talking like that about someone who actually, I paid private school tuition for 21 years. So I'm very sensitive to that thing. And there was a year in my 21 years where it was really tough, right? Because I was in transition and everything else. And, you know, we tightened the belt and made it happen anyway, because we were committed to that. Mm-hmm. Right? But it doesn't, it's not something that everyone can do.
No, but I've had clients that have said to me, I'll sacrifice everything to keep sending my child to Catholic school or to a private school. And, you know, even so, I mean, this is the issue. I mean, people need to be honest with themselves and then be honest financially with what they can afford, and realize that the reason we call it equitable, and a court of equity, is that a judge looks at what's fair overall. I mean, you know, I had an interesting case recently where the parents were making it pretty much the same amount of money. They had one child who was a teenager. They were agreed to pay a lot of money, put a lot of money into his 529 every year, a lot of money for his extracurriculars. And the wife agreed to take a steep discount on the, you know, her share of the former marital home. But there wasn't any child support. And the family thought that these things altogether were equitable. And the judge said, I'm not approving this separation agreement without a child support order.
Really?
And this had been negotiated by this had been the topic of really, really serious negotiations. Afterwards, I think everybody was shocked. All the attorneys and the clients were both shocked. What we ended up doing is submitting an affidavit to the judge, talking about exactly why we made the decision we made, including that these parties are foreign nationals in whose culture it's very important to take care of the grandparents. And one of the grandparents was overseas, and one of the parties needed to spend a lot of money on airfare. So the judge having read that affidavit, finally agreed to a no child support order. So, you know, sometimes, I mean, you know, we think of family as our family, but not all of our clients think of family just in the nuclear terms. So, you know, to the extent that that factors in, that's something the judge might need to hear. It's just, it's very individual, but you need to give the judge reason to deviate, a compelling reason to deviate.
Yeah. Now, so something that just crossed my mind, you know, yes, college is not a necessity, and are, you know, certainly paying private school college tuition. And then, you know, you're saying, well, you know, people are committed, but yet when, if they say that, and then they see how much income they're going to go, they're going to have to go, wait a minute, why does he have all this income and I don't? Because again, the income is different. And how do I know he's going to spend that money on college? And why should I be giving up these RSUs because they're now earmarked for college and I don't get them when I could actually use that money to buy a house? You know, if I sell those stocks, I could buy a house. So, you know, yes, people are committed until they see the numbers and then they're like, whoa, wait a minute, that's not fair. He's going to be able to go away on vacation. I can't. And, you know, so again, because the income, why should a party, I'm not going to say suffer, but why should a party take less because they're committed to their kids in college, even though there is income available for support? You know, why should support be reduced?
And I would say only if they both agree.
Okay.
Only if they both agree.
I think it's something that I think we've been alluding to, and maybe we need to say it out loud here, is that there is a possibility for the parties to agree to having child support and alimony and a third bucket. And a third bucket could be for college, could be for private school, could be for whatever it is that they want to be with. And when you do that, it sometimes helps the payor, the one who has a greater income, because paying child support and alimony is something that they resent, right? That's how it is. Whereas paying money for private school, for instance, is something that they don't resent as much,
right?
That is more acceptable to them. And so that would allow them then to have an agreement that is possibly likely to hold better over time.
Yeah. And, you know, there's trade-offs too. There's child credits, there's head of household if it's a joint custody arrangement. There's, I don't know, you could possibly look at life insurance and what makes sense and how to factor that in. Maybe it's not a whole policy, maybe it's a term policy. I don't know, because it would be cheaper, but there are more tools than people generally use. It's a big toolbox. It's a really big toolbox. And the mistake is getting locked into saying it's alimony or child support, and that's all we're going to deal with.
Yeah. You know, and then the other aspect of that too is, okay, if there is a alimony order along with a college tuition, should the recipient of alimony be contributing to college, even though the payor has all the funds to do so? You know, but on that added income, is there some kind of affordability? You know, like again, like the UMass Amherst, you know, that would amount to maybe $15,000 a year.
Well, you know, generally that's what people generally do. The both spouses have to contribute. But the other factor is that there's not just alimony or support, there's property division. Mm-hmm. So maybe the amount that is generated, the income that's generated off of the division of property, or expected income, makes it equitable for the spouse to contribute 50% or maybe 30% or whatever the UMass benchmark is. But, you know, in those cases where there's an alimony and a support, child support order, there's almost always a division of marital property, and that also needs to be factored in. It sounds more complicated. It sounds complicated, but what it really comes down to is using Diane and Chris to figure out what you need, what you have, and, you know, and identify the points, the gaps, and then the attorneys can get to work on how to, you know, how to like
make it happen,
or if to bridge those gaps, or right, or if it's possible to bridge those gaps.
Bridge those gaps. Yeah. No, that is
without
true.
You guys, we couldn't.
We provide the options. You know, we provide, you know, we provide the necessary information so that informed decisions can be made. That's hopefully the goal of what we do. you know, and those decisions be made collaboratively between all parties. You know, that's the best way to do it, and try to, you know, you can still be involved in litigation, but you can try to negotiate outside of it. You know, if the attorneys are able to collaborate together and find a solution that works for both.
I think we've been consistent since we started this, and all of our guests have been consistent that it is better for parties to agree out of court.
And let me just add, you can partially agree out of court.
Right.
And there are many times when I just did a trial of over three. It was a 3-day trial, but we also handed in a partial separation agreement for the things that we could agree on. Right. And we just tried the things that we couldn't agree on. The judge was more than happy to have that partial separation agreement. It takes so many triable issues off the table that really didn't need to be tried. So that's not all or nothing. You can partially agree, and then the part that you can't agree, do the limited conciliation or the limited trial.
What were the remaining issues, the contested issues? Just
In this case, the parties agreed to every financial provision, and they couldn't agree to the parenting plan.
Ah, interesting.
Wow. Yeah. That's
but great. I have another case which may turn on, which is going to conciliation, which turns on, it's really an accounting case. You know, how much does the husband get a credit for certain payments of college costs? Does the wife get a credit for certain sales of property? And they just can't agree. And hopefully it's going to be like a 2-hour conciliation, and then we can just get on with the separation agreement. But sometimes you just can't agree.
Right. Yeah. Oh boy. Well, obviously this is a difficult topic. And I think what we're showing here is that it's obviously not one size fits all. And I think what is good about the new child support guidelines that came out, and the reason why we say this is because it does tie into alimony, is that the child support guidelines seem to realize that it's not a one size fits all. And that's why they are providing people like us different options. And it's up to us to show those options and find what works best. So, you know, this is not a one size fits all. We have to look at the particular circumstances of the family. We have to look at the history of the family. What have they normally done in the past? What are they going to do in the future? And then try to find something that addresses the needs of both parties.
Right.
And just to all the clients out there, it's so important to tell your attorney everything. Like if you know that 2 days after you are getting divorced, you're going to be living with your new partner, that may affect alimony, you know, that may affect your alimony. So there's nothing that you can't tell your confidential advisors. There's just nothing. And if it's on your mind, then it's something that you should articulate, because making decisions with imperfect information is the worst way to go.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah, because everything has a potential impact. Right. So either negative that we need to mitigate, or positive that we need to emphasize. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, what works for one party doesn't work for the other, most likely. So there's one way that works for one. And, you know, that's that compromise of finding the right amount of support that works for both.
Yeah.
So, well, interesting. I think we have, although we can go on, we could go on. Is there are there any other cases, Sandy, that you can think of, you know, where, you know, like, especially when there are extraordinary expenses in the family, you know, was child support offset? Was alimony offset? Or anything else that you can think of?
Well, there's certain cases where, you know, parents of kids with special needs agree, yes, to establish a special needs trust and put the money in the special needs trust, but to be available for the child when he becomes 22 or is emancipated 18, and I think judges are very sympathetic to that.
Mm-hmm. Continued support after our guidelines.
Right. But that may affect how much you're paying in child support. If you can put aside a certain amount in a special needs trust. And I've had clients do that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes, because again, it's parents often feel less bad about that than they do about paying alimony.
Right.
And so, yeah, and it's a need that both parents have, which is to provide for their children. And so if we can use that third bucket, so to speak, to provide for the needs of the children, it's something that can be mutually agreeable.
Yeah.
It's like that analogy of three legs to a stool. I mean, it's like three buckets to this stool, and you really need to look at all of them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. As we were talking, I drew out three buckets: one with child support, one with alimony, one with tuition. And I'm gonna work on that.
Yeah, great. Send me a copy.
See if I can come up with something to help clients understand. Okay, we got three buckets. How are we gonna fund them here? What are we gonna do? Yeah. Here's the available income. What are we gonna do? Here, you know. So that's an interesting way to look at it. All right. Well, I hope you all have some plans for the Memorial Day weekend coming up. It looks, you know, I don't know, the weather keeps changing up here in New England, which is not a surprise. Sandy, right, you being down on P-Town and me being all the way up in Gloucester, we are on different capes.
Yes. Yes.
The different capes of Massachusetts, Cape Ann and Cape Cod.
And I'm inland.
You're inland. You're actually kind of right in the middle almost.
Yeah.
Kind of, sort of. I don't know.
It's interesting, the differences in weather between the being inland, yes, and close to the water. But anyway, yes. So
yeah, there it is. Cool.
So it's been very interesting, as usual. So thank, we're meeting again both next week, are we?
We have one more. We have our last episode next week. Are going to wrap it all up, the alimony series that we've been doing. We're going to then take a break so that we can come up with a brand new series in September. And I know, Chris, you and I are throwing around ideas, and I actually forgot what idea I even proposed, but I know it was interesting.
Oh, I know it was too.
Yes, it was. Okay. Without saying, right?
All right. It's just, we are all very, very busy right now. You know, with everything going on in the economy, and the divorce cases are being kind of turned upside down with some of the housing market, the interest rates, the availability of rentals and homes to buy. And we are finding a lot of these conundrums that our clients are in. And I think some of it's just going to have to be like, well, you know what, we just got to wait and see what's going to happen here. And a lot of my clients were co-owning the home right now until the economy turns, until maybe they can, buy the other person out, or, you know, who know, or be able to sell and find a place to buy. And so that's kind of some of the issues that we're dealing with right now. So maybe that'll be a topic for the fall.
Very cool. Yeah. All right. Well, I guess it's time to perhaps wrap it for this week. Right. Sandy, thank you so much for joining us. It's been enlightening as always.
And thank goodness Sandy was here. Thank goodness it's Divorce Friday. My gosh.
Yeah. Now I'll go paint my windowsill. That's my big plans for the Memorial Day.
All right. Take care, both.
Right. Okay.
Bye.
Bye.